Our guest speaker tonight comes from Mid-State New York, Dave Bennett.
Let me tell you a little bit about myself before I had my experience. My experience was back in 1983. I used to be the chief engineer of a research vessel. We did underwater exploration, traveled all around the world. It was a great job, dream job. Everybody would love to have it. I was in my mid-20s, and I was the chief engineer of this research vessel. You can imagine, in order to get that position at that young age, you had to kind of cut your swath through that. That was my philosophy. You cut your swath through to survive. I was a pretty brash young man. I was very opinionated. I knew what I wanted, and I went out to get it. Back in 83, we just finished a job where we were evaluating a new ROV submarine, remote operated vehicle. We were going to have to stand off station. There was a heck of a storm going on that night. The Coast Guard was estimating that the swells were somewhere between 25 and 30 feet. The harbor master wouldn't let our ship in. We had a 143-foot research vessel with two submarines on the deck. We were a little too large to make it into the harbor that night. So they asked us to stand off station. Well, the engineer that had designed the submarine that we were evaluating needed to be to LAX next morning. He was quite insistent. Some of the sub-operators, they wanted to go home too. Well, it was pretty rough, so the captain decided that he was going to put a small boat in the water. We decided to use the Zodiac. Now, I don't know if any of you all know about what a Zodiac is, but it's a little rubber boat. You used to see it in the Jacques Cousteau all the time. It's a little rubber boat. We put the Zodiac in, and the captain said, "You know, Dave, I think maybe you should go along." I never handled the small boats. But I was the chief engineer, and I was one of the better boat handlers on the crew. We took a deckhand to do the steering, and I did the navigation because I knew the harbor better than anybody. We got in this little boat. Before we left, we did something that was pretty unique for us. You've got to realize, we're a research vessel, and we're all certified commercial divers. We spent thousands and thousands of hours under the water, and on the water, and in submarines, and that was our life. Went down to Bosun's locker, and we pulled out the life vest. This was probably the first time in many years, probably 5 years since I wore a life vest. But we saw, you know, we were being cautious. It's a rough night out there. And we're gonna put these life vests on. So we dusted them off. Man, I mean, we dusted them off. We had to beat the dirt out of these things. They were so big. They've been sitting down in that locker for a long time. We got in the boat. Before we took a bearing on the harbor with the radar, ship's radar, we could see the harbor buoy occasionally. And so what we would do is we'd try to ride up on top of the swell, take a bearing on the buoy, and then ride the trough, get up on the next swell, take another bearing. Well, you can imagine, we're jumping up and down the air 25 feet, so is the harbor buoy. Okay? Wasn't long before we were lost. And we couldn't find the ship either. So we said, well, good old California shoreline is all lit up. It's over there somewhere. So we started heading in. We didn't know at the time. The storm had blown us a mile south of the harbor. There was a breaker zone over there. And we slid off a 30-foot. That was pretty scary. Suddenly dropped 30 feet about that fast. And so we said, let's turn this thing around and head back out to sea. It's a lot safer out there. And I make it sound like it's really casual. It was more like, turn this thing around! Let's get out of here! And about then, we saw a ridge of foam, and it came right down on top of us. I like to say it folded that Zodiac in half like a peanut butter sandwich. And it ruptured three of the pontoons. I was in the bow, catapulted me out of the bow, into the water. Boy, am I glad I've got this Mae West on. First time in a long time, and boy, this is a rough night. This is definitely here to save my life tonight. And I'm in the water. Now, I'm used to being in the water. And I found, because I've been in some sticky spots before, and I find that when my life's being threatened, that I get a very calm, cool sense about me. I don't know. It's pulled me out of the fire a few times. So I'm in the water, and I'm used to being in the water. So I blow a few bubbles out, see if I can find a location. But I'm being tumbled and tossed, and it's just worthless. And the sand is being pulled up, the sea's so rough. The saltness and the sand, you couldn't even open your eyes. Figure I'm just going to hold my breath and wait for old Mae West to take me up to the surface. That's all I can do. Because I don't dare swim, because I could be swimming down. You know, I've totally lost all sense of direction. Just being tumbled and tossed, and just not handy. And the sea's just roaring. And I'm holding my breath, and I'm holding my breath, and I'm thinking, geez, my life insurance paid up, yeah. I really did. I went through a whole list of stuff that I was worried about. But it was all my fears, you know. I started going through some of my fears, you know. Geez, you know, this is getting pretty bad. I can only hold my breath a little bit longer. And now I was trained as a diver, so I understood what oxygen deprivation was. They train us as commercial divers, we go through it. They actually make us go through it to the point where we almost black out. I was used to that. I knew what that euphoria was, but knowing that I could hold my breath a little bit longer, but eventually you just can't hold your breath any longer. You start to relax. That euphoria takes over and you relax and you breathe in salt. In my experience, I found myself in this total darkness. Total darkness. It was an incredible calm. And I knew that I'm in this storm. And so it was kind of strange. It actually piqued my curiosity. What is this? I never experienced anything like this. And this is the West Coast. On the West Coast, the circulation of the sea is from the north. Unlike the East Coast, where it comes up from the Gulf, it's a nice warm stream. It's cold. And I'm not cold anymore. I was beginning to be freezing in there. I'm not cold, I'm comfortable, and I'm in this darkness, absolute darkness. Well, it started to get light. I started noticing it was getting lighter. And now I know I'm a mile or two offshore, and there are no streetlights up there. Really, I'm still just incredibly amazed at what is happening. There was no fear. I had no sense of fear. This light started coming. It just started growing light. Now, I didn't have the typical go through the tunnel like a lot of experiences, one of the elements. But for me, it just started growing light. And then I finally was able to locate a source. And it felt like I was moving toward it. Now, to this day, I can't tell you if I was moving toward it was moving toward me. I don't know. I really don't. It felt like movement to me. Now, I'm trying to give you the best description I can. But as I got closer to this light, it felt like it was enveloping me. It felt like I was becoming a part of it. And then I started to think, you know, I started looking for my body. Because I realized, I don't think I'm in the water anymore. I've gone somewhere else. And that was when I realized, I think I'd passed. And I started trying to look at myself. And I realized that I was becoming a part of this life. I've had a lot of people ask me to describe the life. For me, the light was like made up of millions and millions of fragments of light. And every fragment felt like a living entity almost. It felt like it was alive and like it was breathing and just pulsing. And as I got closer, I felt like I was becoming a part of it and that I was light. I was becoming light. Three fragments broke off from the light and started moving toward me. And as they moved toward me, I could feel this sense of love like I had never, ever felt before in my life. It was so powerful that it just melted me. It was incredible. It's so hard to describe this love because it's so incredibly powerful. And also from these three, and I started to understand that these were three beings. And it felt like I knew them. Now, I grew up in a really dysfunctional family. It's part of the reason why I felt like I had cut my swath away, was that I didn't really have a sense of family. Suddenly, these beings felt like family to me like I had never known. I had a sense of feeling of family that I'd never known in my life before, and a sense of love and compassion I'd never felt in my life. And eventually, more beings presented themselves, and there was about a dozen. And we started, it felt like just all at once I had this knowing that we needed to proceed. And as we did, I started to relive my life. And I reviewed my life, but not in a way where I was just living my life. I actually was experiencing it through everyone I had interacted with in my life. So like the next time I die, I'm going to get to see this presentation through your eyes. And if it touched you, I get to feel that. It's incredible. And it's intense. And it's just, and you get to see these ripples of your interactions and actions. And I got to see things in my life review that I wasn't too proud of. In fact, I was judging it pretty harshly because I did some stuff in my life that I was ashamed of. And I didn't want this newfound family of mine to have to witness this because they were experiencing it with me. And I was ashamed of that. I didn't want them to see it. But the most amazing thing was they weren't judging me. I was judging myself. They weren't. They had no judgment toward me. They supported me. They supported me through those tough periods of my life. They supported me through the good periods of my life. And they got the most joy whenever I did something in my life where I treated another individual with a loving intention. I saw that that meant more than all the things that I held pride for, like becoming the chief engineer of this research vessel, things like that, didn't really have a huge impact in this life review. What really stood out was when I did something with another person, and I did it with loving intention. I tell you, it was humbling. And as we went through this life review, I got to see that there's an interaction between us all the time. And you don't have to be physically present to have an interaction with someone. Even in your thoughts, when we think about someone, when we think about them, if we think about them with a ill intent or with loving thoughts, we're having an interaction with them. And you don't have to be in their presence. And all of this just, to tell you the truth, I was in awe. So much so that I was having a tough time taking it all in. And they just kept supporting me. Kept loving me. It got to a point I started seeing things that I couldn't relate to. They weren't something I had lived. I started seeing stuff that I didn't have a reference to, and it really disoriented me. I tried to get a grasp on it, and they just buoyed me up even more. Sorry, I have to use naval terms. I kind of say it. It buoyed me up a little more. And I have to make light of it, or I'll be up here crying. I'm sorry, okay? I finally reached a point where I heard this voice. And this voice said to me, "This is not your time. You have to return." No way. I'm not going. I like it here. I found a family I never knew I had. There's no way. I know that body's getting beat up, and I'm not going back there. I don't want anything to do with it. Nothing. The voice came back and said, "You have to return. You have a purpose." And the word purpose just resonated. And this voice, you have to understand, was the most loving, compassionate voice. But it was also commanding. It was saying, "No, you have to return." I understood. And there's something about being in that light that you have an understanding that's beyond our physical comprehension, beyond what we're capable of here. And so when I heard that word purpose, I understood it. And like I said, it just resonated within my being. And when I heard that, I accepted that. Because I understood it, I had to accept it. Once I had accepted it, I found myself outside of my body. And I was watching. It's in the ocean. It's still being tossed by the waves. Somehow, the bow line of this zodiac and the wreckage and the flotsam that's all a part of it now had wrapped itself around this arm. And the bitter end of the line was beating my chest. And I'm watching this. And another set of waves comes, and one pontoon had a little bit of air left in it. And it, when that wave hit, it acted like a rubber band almost. It shot up, and when it did, that line got taut, pulled my shoulder right out of its socket, and yanked me up to the surface. The waves kept pounding me, and when they did, they pushed a little bit of water out. And it was right then that I felt myself being pushed back into my body. Dying is hard, but returning to life is even harder. I say that over and over. I kind of want to share with you, I've had three experiences. That was my first experience. The next two experiences built upon that first experience. We still had a mile to swim that night. The rest of the guys that were in the boat had rallied around a flashlight. They were looking for me, and they'd been looking for me for quite a while. And in fact, they were at the point where they were going to give up. And somehow I was tangled around this boat, but I kept slipping beneath the surface. And all the time I'm thinking, I could go home, but purpose, 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 purpose. It was just ringing in my head. I couldn't get it out of my head. So I tried to fight. I tried to fight to live. But I kept being dragged under. I couldn't understand it. And if it wasn't for that wreckage and that flotsam, I probably would have drowned again. When you immediately come back from one of these experiences, I felt like I was half here and half there. I felt like I still had a connection to that light and to that knowing. And through that, I had an intuitive knowing that there was something wrong with this life vest that I had on. So I opened it up, and sure enough, the inside of the life vest had dry rotted, and the lining was just little shreds. And the water had gotten into the fiber filling, and it was actually acting like an anchor. That's what was pulling me down all this time. I like to stop at this point and say, so what was supposed to save me killed me. But I was saved by the bitter end. Gotta laugh about it, you know? It was a tough night. We made it in, and we made it home. When I got home that evening, my wife had had a dream that I had died. And I was really out of it, I have to say, because I didn't know what had just happened. I was trying to deal with it. It was so profound, I was trying to deal with what just happened to me. And I get to the front door, and I'm thinking, the sea was so bad, it actually ripped the shirt right off my back. All I had on were my pants and my socks, one sock. And my pockets were full of sand. And I realized this outside my door. And I thought, you know, if I go in the house like this, she will kill me. I started to strip right in front of me. This is in California. And I was in one of those apartment complexes where all the doors face each other. So it's like a common courtyard. And she heard me outside the door, and so she looked through the peephole, she saw it was me, opened the door, drags me inside. What are you doing? But the minute she touched me, I was gray, ashen cold still. And she was an LPN, so she knew. She put me in the bath, and she started pouring cold water on me, and I thought she was scalding me to death. And so I looked up at her, and I said, you know, hon, I think I died. It was the last straw for her. It drove her over the edge because she had that dream that I died, and she was already freaked out because I wasn't supposed to be home tonight anyway. And here I show up looking like death warmed over, and she just started smacking me. It scared me because she started freaking out. It was beyond her capability of dealing with it. So I mental note to myself, you know, I can't share this with her. For 2 days, I felt like I was half here and half there. I felt like I was still had that connection. I didn't realize I was a chief engineer. I saw things in black and white. You know, things either go this way or they go that way. And as an engineer, that's just the way you start to think after a lot of years. Suddenly, I started being faced with. I was seeing. I didn't have names for some of this stuff. I didn't know how to describe this. I started seeing like life forces. And I saw it in trees, palm trees, amazing. I was seeing it in rocks. I was seeing it in flowers. And we had these beautiful gardens around our apartment. And I was beat up really bad, let me tell you. By the time sunrise came up, I could barely walk. I was so beat up. But I couldn't stay inside. I wanted to get outside. And for 2 days, I started seeing these life forces. I started getting these knowings, these understandings. I knew things, like things my wife was going to tell me before she told me. The strange stuff. And I'll tell you, I didn't like it because it didn't fit in my world. It freaked me out. And I'm an engineer, you know, I never studied this, and so how should I know this? And I've never read that or heard anything about it. How am I supposed to know these things? So as an engineer, you test things and find out how real it is. And so I would test these knowings. And over time, I began to rely on them. I came back, and This experience so freaked me out that I thought, I can't share it with my wife. I can't share it with my coworkers because we put our lives in each other's hands every day. I can't share this because death is a taboo subject on board a ship with a bunch of divers. You just don't talk about it. So I felt incredibly isolated. I felt like I couldn't share this with anyone. It freaked me out because you don't go into that light and these light beings and this voice. Only special people get to talk to that voice. And I'm not one of them. I tried to forget it. I really did. I tried to put this behind me. I don't want anything to do with it. But there were three things that stood out that I was able to accept. I call it, the first one was acceptance. I had taken such an in-depth look of my life and who I was, who is Dave Bennett, that I suddenly knew who I was. And for a guy in his mid-20s, that's a pretty big step. And I knew who I was. And I know I got some problems, but I can work on it. And that was, for me, so acceptance. One of the gifts that I felt that I received from this experience, acceptance. The second one was tolerance. I saw all these interactions in my life and how other people can have paths in their life. And I may not agree with it, but I could be tolerant of it. Because it's their life. It's their stuff. It's not mine. And I could be tolerant of it. That was a totally new concept. And the third gift was my truth. I suddenly had a new understanding of truth. That all of us can experience the same event. We can all go through the same experience, all at the same time. And every one of us is going to come away with a slightly different truth. And your heart knows that. Usually when you come across your truth, your heart sings. And so I took these three gifts, and I kept testing this intuitiveness that I suddenly was gifted with. And I just decided the rest of it, I don't want to remember. I'm just going to put it away. Put it in a big old box, tie it up with a bow, put it as far back in my mind as I can, and a big old sign, do not touch. And I went on with my life. Well, a funny thing happened when you suddenly have acceptance, tolerance, and truth. My wife calls it AT&T. Because I spew it all the time. Acceptance, tolerance, and truth. A funny thing happened. I was working offshore. I mean, 9 months out of the year, I was offshore with a small group of people, didn't have any inside influences. I had no way of, you know, understanding any of this or coming to grips with it. And I felt like I wasn't being of service. I felt like I needed to be of more service. I needed something more. It started to become a driving theme in my life. I needed more. I can't just continue doing this career because it's just too shut in. And I started working in healthcare because I felt like I was doing more good. I thought I had a pretty good handle on this whole near-death thing, dying thing. At the time, I was still calling it the dying thing. And about 10 years after my experience, my near-death, my NDE, I went on this spiritual retreat. I found this group. Eventually, I totally left offshore work. Started working in hospitals and came back to New York State, to Syracuse, and started working at St. Joseph's Hospital there and became manager of the dialysis program. Now, how's that happen? Everybody asks me that question, so I'm going to answer it right off the bat. Intuitiveness was putting me in the right place at the right time and was just, you know, just kind of like steering me a little bit. It was like it was my rudder, you know, it was giving me a rudder. It allowed me to follow this path. And I became certified as a nephrology chief, which is not a simple thing to do, but I didn't even study for the test. I just knew it. It was very freaky. But I was beginning to rely on it. And I thought, you know, I've really got this whole thing figured out. I've got it licked. You know, I got this whole thing. You can't touch me. I've got it licked. Boy, don't ever think like that. Don't ever think like that, because boy, the hammer's about to fall. I went on a spiritual retreat. Part of my younger years, I grew up in Sedona, Arizona. the spiritual group was going back there for a retreat, and I thought, oh yeah, you know, I like these guys, they're a good group of people, and I can go hike some of my little trails, some of my stomping grounds. This is going to be a win-win for Dave, you know. And we got there, and the leader asked us to just find a quiet place in the tent for 30 minutes. You know, this little grotto that I thought would be a nice place to sit and just look at the vistas and find a nice quiet place within me. And I started to go into what I call my sacred space within. And I heard that voice, and it said, "Return to the light." And that was the last thing I wanted to do. And it freaked me out, because suddenly this knowing is talking. This is a voice, and I am not dead. And it really freaked me out. I started reliving my near-death experience. Started reliving the entire experience, going from the darkness into the light, meeting this family of mine. I started going through the life review again. They call this a near-death-like experience because I wasn't really near-death. There was nothing threatening my life. But they call it a near-death-like experience. And I started going through the life review again. Only this time in the life review, when I got to the point where I didn't have a reference, I realized I had pre-lived some of my life in the first experience. Because now I got to re-experience 10 years of my life that I had seen before that I didn't realize I was seeing before. It disoriented me. But now I understood it. For another 3 days, I couldn't get this experience out of my head. It stayed with me for 3 days. Everything. I would see a person, and I could see their spirit, and it would take me back to the experience. So I hid myself in my hotel room. I kind of sequestered myself away from this group. But the neat thing about this group was one of the members was Tom Sawyer. Okay, well, Tom Sawyer is another near-death experiencer who's published 2 books, had been working with a lot of the researchers for many, many years. His best friend, Richard, was the guy who found me when I was trying to come out of this reliving this experience. For the second time, I tried to tell somebody about it, and it happened to be Richard, Tom Sawyer's best friend. He knew, and he gave it a name. He called it a near-death experience. And you don't, it was incredible validation for me. Incredible validation to have a name. And Richard said, "You're not alone. There's a lot of people have this experience." Oh my God, I'm not the only freak in the place, you know? I mean, it was liberating for me. Before, I told you I felt like I had to be of service, and I felt like I took acceptance, tolerance, and truth, and I used that. And that momentum, I think, is what... But what happened, what happened here in the second experience is that I had reached a crisis. I had suppressed it for so long that I finally reached some sort of crisis within myself that I had to deal with the rest of it. So I couldn't leave it alone until I accepted the light beings, the life review, the love. Has anybody told you today that you're loved? Let me tell you that you are loved. Please let me be the one. I finally got it. I had to relive it the second time to finally really get it. And so now, I took this second experience and I felt, you know, I can't just play with it. I've got to live it. I've got to start walking my own talk. But I still, remember, I hadn't shared it for 10 years. I'm not going to start a new habit overnight, okay? I got real good at hiding this near-death experience. When people would ask me, "How'd you know that?" "Well, that comes with experience." You know, I do all kinds of things to hide it, you know. I got real good at it. So if I had 10 years, almost 11 years of hiding it, and suddenly I'd come to this realization I need to start walking my talk. So I thought the best way to deal with this was to start what I call my quiet ministry. I'm going to live my life with what I've learned from this near-death experience. And I'm going to apply it to my life as much as I can. And the more I did that, the more comfortable I got with it. And it became more, you know, it developed from discipline into a habit. And from a habit, it became a part of my true being, part of who I am now. As I was living my life, trying to put it in perspective of this near-death experience and what I learned in the life review and the way we interact with everyone and the love that's available to all of us. And so I tried to interact with people in more loving ways and that sort of thing. It was amazing how my life started to change again. Only good and bad. Because the second experience is when I feel I really truly started to integrate my experience. I really started to, make it a part of who I am. It created a lot of chaos. It destroyed my first marriage. Because I wasn't the person she married. I wasn't that adrenaline junkie diver guy anymore that she loved. I was a calmer, peaceful guy. I wasn't that opinionated guy that she used to know. I was working on judgment. Boy, I'm still working on judgment. I just wasn't that guy. So our relationship just fell apart. In fact, all relations were tough. I don't know what it is for poor experiencers, but relationships are tough. It's hard when you're trying to be this loving person and relating to people. They misunderstand that love. They misunderstand it sometimes. It can be very confusing. I continued with my quiet ministry because it was what felt right. And I feel like, I ran into a book by P.M.H. Atwater, Returning from the Light. It talked about how experiencers, how their love changes. And I'll tell you, it was like a light bulb went on for me. There's a lot of resources out there, and I suddenly started to realize that there's a lot to learn. I'll tell you, I grew. I grew exponentially because of the resources that are available to us now that I didn't know about. I became the manager of this dialysis program, and I was working, and Spirit was guiding me, actually chattering my ear off sometimes. And I was learning to accept what Spirit would direct me to do. I call it Spirit. A lot of times I feel that family, that soul family that I met there, I feel it's them. Because I feel like I'm so much a part of them and they're so much a part of me that it's them that are talking to me. In fact, I have a few names of a couple of them. And I can sometimes tell which one it is that's talking to me. I was in my office one day, and all of a sudden it felt like my back exploded. Incredible pain. All I could see was red haze. The pain was so intense. Dumb me. I'm so thick-headed. I walked into my director's office and said, I don't think I can make it to the next meeting. I'm going to go over to the emergency room. I walked to the ED from my office, which is a block. I reported to the triage nurse and I said, I reported my symptoms. I can't feel anything down this arm. My back feels like it exploded. I said, I can't even see straight. The pain is so intense. And they thought I was having a cardiac arrest. So they carted me, put on 12 lead EKG, and I'm like, I really want some pain medicine and maybe some x-rays. And they're like, no, no, no. So, but remember, I had acceptance, tolerance of truth, right? So I accepted, this is my path, that was theirs, and I'm going to have to live through it for a little while until they figure out that it's not a heart attack. God bless them. God bless them. They're doing their job. They decided to do the x-rays. Again, they wouldn't give me the pain medicine. They got so absurd that they actually had me hold these little sandbags to stand up straight and took the x-rays, then made me jump on the steel table, more x-rays, twist me here, twist me there. Excruciating. I was crying. I was crying. Sent me back to my room. And then the nurse comes in. And now the nurse, the synchronicity, you gotta love it. The nurse used to be my secretary while she's going to nursing school. Knows me really, really well. And she comes in and she's crying. And I'm going, uh-oh. Uh-oh. I've seen this before. I saw this in my life with you. I know what's going on. And in a minute, the doctor came in. And he's doing this. Shuffling his feet. Well, Dave, I need to tell you something. And I know the next time I go, when I pass, I'm going to see this. And I'm probably not going to be too proud of it, but I let him squirm. he told me that we found these masses in your lung, in your right lung. It's almost completely gone. And it's exacerbated out into your spine, eaten away two bones in your spine, and your spine's collapsed. We need to keep you for some more tests. I could accept it because I knew immediately what it was. And it's funny, they won't call it cancer. And so they kept me in the hospital for about a week. And they found out I had lesions in my hip, my brain, my kidneys. It was in my bones. It was moving incredibly fast. And they said, you know, Dave, we'll keep you comfortable. You can stay here in the oncology ward. And, you know, we'll do everything we can for you. I recommend you get your affairs in order right now. And I'm like, no way. I know, because I saw, I'm going to live past this. And we're going to treat it. And I need to talk to some doctor. I need to talk to an oncologist and this and that. And I used my guidance and some help from some doctor friends that I'd known, all the doctors. As a manager, you know all the doctors and on staff. So I got to handpick my healthcare team. I'm very fortunate in that. We treated it. I used my inner guidance and traditional medicine and some holistic approaches. My guidance finally started showing me that the masses had reduced some. So I asked for tests. I said, can I get another CAT scan or something? They didn't say no, but they sure didn't schedule it. Now I got to defend them here. I have to defend them because they had my best interest at heart. They did not want to test me because they didn't want to give me any more bad news because they know what's happening and they were just appeasing me to treat me to begin with. They know that I'm on my way out and it's just a matter of time. They don't know how I've lived this long as it was. So there's no need to test you. And so they wouldn't schedule it until I really insisted and then I realized insurance would pay for it. Okay. They did the test and then nobody read the results for a month. Again, they were trying to be compassionate to me. They were really trying to help me out.
Maybe their own parent did.
Yeah, well, it's their outcomes. They see these outcomes on a day-to-day basis. And somebody who's got lung cancer, that it's in their spine, it's moving incredibly fast, lesions already in their hip, their brain, their kidney. It's beyond stopping, in their view. Well, I knew all the nurses, because some of them had worked on our staff before, so I threatened them. Read the result. And they did. They read the result and they said, you know, we really need a doctor to look at it. And the doctor read it and he came back and he said, you know, Dave, we have some really good results here for you. We need to send you for some more tests. They sent me for more tests. They sent me for a PET scan. They found that all the cancer in my body was gone. Within 4 months, they said, whatever you're doing, Dave, just keep doing it. But we want you coming back here every, you know, 3-4 months and getting tested and poked and prodded. And I agreed to it. And they wanted to do another round of chemo. And I said, no, it's done. It's over. We're not doing it. It's my rightest patient I can abuse. That was 7 years ago. And I'm still cancer-free. Just had a test not that long ago. But I had to live with a broken spine for over a year. Because, you know, they felt it was going to flare back up. I still have my right lung is pretty much gone, but I have the masses there still. And they think it's going to just explode any minute. That's their reality, not mine. I choose not to accept their reality. It took a year to convince them that they should intervene with my spine. And I had 3 spine surgeries. I learned how to get myself out of that wheelchair. Today I'm standing before you. No cane. I still can't feel my feet or my hands, but that's a small price to pay. I have pain. Through this, the first two, the near-death experience, the near-death light experience, and that life review showed me about the cancer, showed me I had life beyond the cancer. And remember, purpose, 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 it's still ringing in my head to this day. But now they've made me totally disabled. And it allows me to do some real work now. I'm able to talk to other experiencers. I lead the Upstate New York IANS chapter. I have a website, and I talk to a lot of cancer patients as well. Terminal, those that are given up on a lot of times. It allows me to do that work. So I feel like I'm even more of service now than I ever was in my entire life. I feel freer than I ever was in my entire life because I'm able to do what I know Spirit really has planned for me to do in my whole life. I really feel like my narrative experience was giving me the roadmap I needed to get to where I am right now. It was validation. The cancer and going through all that cancer was validation for me. It proved to me how real the near-death experience is. Because I saw all of that. And it gave me the strength and the faith, I hate to use that word. It gave me the absolute knowing that I was going to live beyond this cancer. And that was a leg up. Those are my three experiences. I call my three transformational experiences. Because each one of them, you grow through. And a lot of them had a lot of suffering wrapped around them. They make you stronger. And they give you the tools you need to live your life. And when you pay attention, I think a lot of times we can, you know, we can get where we need to go. I want to thank you for being a very attentive audience and allowing me to share my experience with you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a question session now to ask. Feel free to ask any question that comes to your mind and make it as hard as you want.
I just would love for you to tell us about your family. I see a wedding ring, and I assume that there's some special woman in your life, and maybe some little chicklings or something.
No little chicklings.
Oh, spiritual ones.
Oh, yeah. I have a gang of spiritual friends. I'm married again. I found someone special that understands the near-death experience, allows me to be an experiencer. That's important. It's very hard to find. I feel I'm blessed with Cindy, my wife, because, and I really think this is something I'd love to see developed is a program that we could have at IANS groups where the experiencer's family can relay what it's like living with an experiencer. It's not easy. I see some experiencers nodding their head. You know, we have a lot of issues we come back with because we have this duality we're living with, and it makes life incredibly difficult. So I find myself very lucky that Cindy's in my life. And the funny thing was we were dating when I got the cancer diagnosis. God bless her. She was a little mad I didn't call her sooner. That, you know, I didn't tell her until that evening that I wasn't coming home. I was in the emergency room all day. So she was a little mad at me. But she went through, I tried to push her away because I knew what I had to go through with the cancer and everything. And she was so strong that she, you know, stepped up and wouldn't let me push her away. And she was, I mean, she's an amazing person in my life now, an incredible strength in my life. She was so accepting of me knowing that I was going to live beyond this cancer that in the midst of the treatments and everything, we bought a house. We started moving on with our life. It's nice to have a partner like that. And I mean, we're really partners. You know, so, yeah, thanks for that question. I love to give her credit.
After your second experience, were you able to talk to other people about near-death experience besides the few people that were in?
Yeah, it was kind of neat. Because Tom Sawyer, who I mentioned, lives in upstate New York, and we became really good friends. And he helped me to understand a lot of what was normal and what isn't normal for an experiencer. But also, with other groups, I started to share. And at first it was hard. It's very hard to share this experience for an experiencer because it's such a personal experience. It's so, you know, it's all about you, kind of, like. And it's very hard to share that because you're opening your entire heart up to share it. It was hard at first. And I shared with small, trusted people and another problem with sharing is a vocabulary. How do you talk about something? How do you describe colors that don't exist in this world? How do you describe that light? There's just no expletives in our language that allows us to describe it and give it justice, you know? How do you describe that love that's so powerful that it feels like it's more than you, it's more than this world, it's more than this universe? It's a part of everything. You know, I mean, where do you get that vocabulary at first, and how do you share it with people? My experience was, in next spring, it'll be 25 years. It's taken me this long to be able to talk to you like I am today. And I still get choked up, and I live with it every day. My experience is a part of my everyday life.
David, thank you for what you've shared very much. I'm very grateful. And I have a question. I have a cancer client, and are you willing to share your website or contact information for me to pass on to her?
Certainly. My website is my personal website. This isn't our upstate New York Guidance website. Is Dharma, Dharma, then a hyphen, talks, talks.com. Yeah, ever contact me. My information's on my website. With cancer patients, I try to really encourage, you know, that they don't sequester themselves. It's awful easy, I'm sure you're aware, to kind of go in the closet with cancer. It's, I don't know why, but almost like a shame attached to being a cancer patient. I don't know why. I think we need to ask all our friends and neighbors and associates to, you know, to get out and help with, you know, lending some love, you know, some prayer and stuff like that. I think that's it. I did that with mine. We even had, Cindy's mom had this excellent idea of having all of her friends and family and people who knew me and loved me to knit, crochet a square, and while they were crocheting it, to just think of loving me. Just think of loving me. And then they assembled this, and they got so many squares that they had more than enough for a napkin. They actually made a shawl as well. I still have the afghan. When you wrap that afghan around you, you can feel it. You can feel love. It's incredible. And the same with the shawl. And I donated the shawl to the cancer group that I work with, and it's a pass-along shawl. But I mean, things like that, you know, get the networks going.
Being that your NDE was such a profound and life-changing experience, I would like to know, how did it affect your ability to relate with other people? Did you find it harder to make conversation with a stranger? And how did you cope with that?
There's so many facets to that question. Your friends and close associates, you know, that when you first start to share it, some of your friends can't accept it, and you may end up losing some friends. It's hard. It's very hard. So then you feel rejected all over again, and your mind starts telling you things, you know, and you try to. It's almost like two steps forward, one step back, and when it comes to sharing. The question was, it's a continuation of the question, is it harder to make small conversation and talk about everyday type of subjects? Not really, because I look at the experience in the way I live my life. I try not to impose it on someone else. So if I'm going to go to the coffee shop with Jeff, one of my best friends, or Steve, and we're going to just sit down and catch up on what's going on in life, we don't have a problem. They're not experiencers. They're just good friends. They know that I'm an experiencer. They can't even set foot in an IANS meeting because it's beyond their capability. But we're still good friends. I think it can be. I met this one individual in Chicago who had just had a near-death experience within a year. And he was at a point where he couldn't do anything but try to relate this experience, and people were closing doors in his face, and it was incredibly difficult for him. So I think it's different for every experiencer. I'm at a point now where I have no fear of talking about my experience anymore, which has taken me a long time to get there. But many people in our group will not come up and talk in front of our group. And I respect that. If you're an experiencer and you're not ready to share it, don't share it. Keep it, you know, work with it, grow with it. Eventually you'll be able to talk about it a little more. I think listening to other experiencers help experiencers to be able to talk and to be able to live their life a little easier, because it's, you got to live in this real world, and you got to pay the rent, and you got to be real, you know. And I firmly believe that. because every experience is so different. It's communication is one of the biggest stumbling blocks, especially when it comes to relationships. I was pretty, I almost want to say numb, because there are times when, like when I'm talking to a group here, I'm not afraid to open my heart and allow some of that light to be present. A lot of people can feel that. And so when I'm in public, I try not to be so, because I consider that invasive to other people. Because they can feel it. They may not understand what it is, but they can feel it. And that's where I had a lot of problems with relationships, because I would get to know someone and I would open my heart more and more when I'm around them, and they would feel this love coming from me. And they may not understand what it is, that it's just friendship, and that it's so easy to have it misinterpreted. And that makes part of the talking to people in relationships. I've learned to how I can rein it in a little bit. I'm not putting any conditions on my love for people. I misinterpret their signals, which is really bad, you know.
I wonder if you would please share with us about your perceptions. You said on the other side you had a family, and first you said there were three, then you said that they increased to approximately 12. Were they formless beings? What kind of energy? Did they have masculine, feminine energy? Could you explain that?
Yeah. I love that question, because I love this family that I've come to know. To me, they were light beings, but to me, they are a part of, they are a family, and it's more than just the word family that we use here. We are a part of each other. And when I was there in the light, and sometimes even in dream state or, you know, other things, sometimes I can see them. I see them as basically balls of light, but there's kind of a silhouette of a face, but I can almost see, I can see their eyes. And their eyes are just amazing. Like I said, they're just so close to me. There's one in particular, I call him Peter. Peter and Ariel, they're the two of the closest ones that speak to me the most. They're like my best buds. And they're with me a lot. They're with me right now, in fact. I mean, the love I feel from them is just, it's sometimes it's overpowering. I mean, like they're holding me right now, it's just, that's all I can do to keep it together.
Do they still teach you things?
Yeah. They put me in a place I need to be a lot. My guidance isn't the type of guidance where I can foresee the future or anything as grand as that. My guidance is mostly to help me live my life and to be there. So it puts me in a situation where I'm there. And a lot of times things just fall out of the sky. In fact, this meeting fell out of the sky for me. Ellen called me. I said, "You want me to come here when? Before Thanksgiving?" I mean, my schedule is so packed, you know. There's no way. I said, "But let me look at my calendar. I'll double check my calendar." I looked at my calendar and it was just perfect for me to come here. And I was like, okay, you know, I guess that's why that slot didn't get filled up, you know. Yeah, it just, they allow me to be where I need to be when I need to be. Life for me unfolds now. I allow it to just happen. And it's an amazing thing to do, to release control of your life and to just allow it to happen. That's how I live my life now.
Your relationship to this family, on where it's at. Have you received any kind of a inkling or an instinctive understanding of this family? What would be your ultimate outcome of your life and your whole projection into this next world coming? What do you anticipate for yourself?
I anticipate going back with this family. We're going to probably spend eternity together, you know. I feel that they are we are so a part of each other. It's beyond anything that I knew in this life. And I know this. I have no doubt about it. I have no fear. When my time comes, I'm going to rejoice. And one thing I like to say, I didn't get to say it earlier. In my near-death experience, I really fought, and I multiplied my own suffering in fighting. Next time, I'm going to let go a lot quicker. And I'm thinking about people that are terminally ill or in hospice care that are just hanging on and hanging on, you know. If we could teach them to just let go, their suffering would be so much more reduced, and I think it would be just so much more loving for them, you know. And I know a lot of experiences, at least in my area, have gone into hospice care because that's how they feel they can be of service. And I think that's a wonderful benefit. But one thing else I would never ever do is I would never ever do anything to shorten this life's experiences. When I got that cancer diagnosis that said, we're going to just make you comfortable and let you go, my brain went, yoo-hoo! I'm going home. But I heard that, this purpose, and I knew I couldn't. And that's what the near death was for me. It was telling me that, you know, showing me that once I reached that point in my life, I had more work to do.
I wanted to know, have you changed your diet?
Have I changed my diet?
Only because I wondered what your relationship with animals is, and diet has a lot to do with animals. So that I was wondering about that, and whether or not you saw animals and trees and beautiful things.
I'm as human as the next guy, and my pendulum swings. But I listen to my guidance. There are times when I just can't even be anywhere near me. But there are other times that I crave it too, you know. And it's okay, and it grounds me sometimes. Sometimes when I need to be grounded, some protein really does it for me. That's one of my favorite proteins. But I've really lessened on the meats and I really love fish, though. Fish and salads, and boy, give me a tuna salad. Grilled tuna and salad, man. I guess I probably have in the long run, because like I never go to fast food places. You'll never see my foot in there, just because I don't care for it. I can't say I have put my mindfulness attached to it. I spend so much time keeping my I still live with pain on a day-to-day basis. A lot of my focus goes towards managing that pain because I don't take any pain medication at all. I have 3 spine surgeries to get my spine back. Because once they started really investigating, I have bone disease. Because of all my years as a diver, all the pressure-related disease, I have a degenerative bone disease that is... my cervical, I was a sneeze away from being quadriplegic. I use my mindfulness to encapsulate the pain and to set it aside so that I can live my life. Because the problem I have with the pain medicine is it masks it, and then I hurt myself. I'm the first guy to admit I do stupid stuff. All the time. And if you mask my pain, I will be stupid. I get stupider. And the drugs make me dumber too. They don't help. And not only that, but the drugs masks my communication spirit.
All of us are looking for purpose in life, because everybody I've met, and you've now said purpose, purpose, purpose.
Oh, I knew this one was coming.
Yeah, so we love a definition.
Okay. I always think this question comes up all the time. Purpose, purpose, purpose. What is purpose? What's life purpose? All that stuff. I feel we have a lot of purposes in life. And I really think that our paths are allowed to be a little windy, you know. Because I feel we all have our free will. This is just me, and if this doesn't feel right to anybody in the room, please throw it away. This is my belief. And all I'm doing tonight is my belief. So, like I said, if this doesn't resonate with you, throw it away. You don't have to take on my stuff, just like I don't have to take on your stuff. But as far as the way I see purpose is, we all have a winding road. I see it as like multiple paths, but with a core purpose. And a lot of your life purpose, we need to listen and be very attentive to our surroundings. There are a lot of signals that I think we're all receiving. Sometimes they're just gifts. That let us know we're in the right place at the right time. We need I don't believe you can get off your soul's purpose path. I believe you can plop down in the middle of it and not refuse to go any further. But I don't think you can get off the path. But I think because there are a lot of your life's purpose has all these winding paths going down a core avenue, that you can take a lot of these little side adjuncts, you know, on the way. And that's your free will. But I believe we have multiple purposes along the way. And I think they evolve as we grow older and hopefully wiser.
In your life review, how much of your life did you see, and have you lived past that point, or are you still seeing things that are to come?
There's a few that I'm waiting for, and I'm not going to talk about.
But you actually haven't seen your death then, or I mean, you don't know how far you've seen up to then, basically, you're saying?
I have seen, there are future events that I still recall from my life review. So I know I've got some time left. I'm not going to forecast that, because I could be wrong. Because I found, here's an example. The cancer, in my life review, I saw I was going to deal with cancer. But in my life review, and so I knew that. I was walking around with that knowledge, knowing that at some point in my life. And when I actually was experiencing some symptomology, I was getting some back pains, and I was getting some numbness down this arm, and I was attributing it to carpal tunnel and to other things that were going on in my life, and because I thought that what I saw was going to happen much later in life. I didn't think it was going to happen. So one thing that mystifies me is the timing around what I saw in my life review. I can't tell you exactly when these future events are going to happen for me, but I'm looking forward to a couple of them.
I wonder if you can comment a little more on the conflict. You mentioned the duality. This is something I struggle with, and I know many experiencers do, that the value system is so different. I mean, your life review shows you all these amazing earthly things you have done at such a young age, and it's quite commendable. And yet that seemed insignificant. And it's those little acts of kindness. And yet in the world consciousness, those things are considered nothing.
In fact, in the world consciousness, they're considered a weakness a lot of times.
Yeah. I wonder if you could comment on... there's so much pressure on goal setting, which is, to me, very closely tied to control, and money, making money, being wealthy, what have you, versus this mentality you've been sharing with us about unfolding and love. If you could contrast those and maybe give some insight after 25 years how you have developed skills in juggling those conflicts.
Wow. I'll try to take it a little bit at a time here. The goal setting. I do, part of my goal, one of my first goals once I realized I needed to get it together was to try to find gratitude in all life's experiences. And by doing that, I actually had to start looking at my life experiences. To be grateful for them, I had to pay attention to what was happening. And when I started to pay attention to what was happening in my life, I started reviewing. And through that review, I could set goals for myself. So now what I try to do is I try, and I recommend this to everyone, experiencer or non-experiencer, just take a look at what happened today. Was there things that you didn't care for? Were there things in your life that you thought you did well? Don't judge it. Just review it. What could you do next time that would maybe handle that situation a little better? Maybe you lost your temper a little quicker than you wanted to. Maybe you lost your temper you didn't want to. You know, was there a better way of dealing with those situations? Through that, I was able to set goals for myself. Like I said, I was a very judgmental person, and I still fight with that. 25 years later, I try not to be judgmental as much as I can. But I can catch myself a lot quicker now, because I review and I've given myself some tools. And it's helped me with those goals. Sorry, I got so wrapped up in the goal part, I'm forgetting the next part of the question.
I was just dealing with the conflict, the money issues, goal setting in the sense of how trying to control your life versus what you're suggesting is more of an unfolding, take life as it comes and experience it fully.
Yeah. Money, your goals, I mean, that's a part of life. You have to pay the bills, you gotta have some revenue coming in. And you can't just sit down in your bath and expect it to all just come your way. You've gotta live your life and you've gotta participate in life and ask for, you know, your fair compensation. An experiencer has even more trouble with that because the whole monetary system doesn't really have a huge value in life anymore. Because I don't feel like I need to be rich and wealthy and I could care, you know. I've thrown a lot of that away. And it's hurt me because there are times when I should have accepted some, and then all of a sudden something came up where that money would have been exactly what I needed to handle that situation. So I think through time I've learned to accept what's given, but I'm really not looking for more than what I need. That's tough. That's a tough balance, and it's taken me a long time to get to a point where I can feel a little comfortable with it. Like right now, I'm disabled, but one of the things I do to help supplement my income is I build these altars. PMA Jadwater was telling me, she's like, well, Dave, give me your website so I can make a link on my website. I've got thousands of visitors that come through and la la la. And I'm like, well, PMH, I'd like to do that, but I don't want that much business. She's like, Dave, you're such an experiencer, you know. And then when I do sell them, I want to sell them so that people can afford them, you know. So I'm not making any money on these altars, but I get what I need. I'm trying to use some real-life experiences so that you can relate a little bit. The money issue is huge. It's a tough one. It's a tough nut to crack, and I think you got to look within and your guidance what's going to work for you. I'm not going to profess to have all the answers. I'm an experiencer like the next guy, and I'm still puzzling it out, and I probably will until I pass again. You know, and I'm not too proud to say it. You know, I'm fighting this every day, you know, trying to come to grips with it. Now, the duality, I hope everybody can experience this duality. I think it would help the world. Probably not going to happen, but not in our lifetime, unfortunately. But that knowing of another world that is larger than us and that we have to live in this physical existence that is limiting, constrictive, such a fight sometimes to live this life, knowing that there's so much more available to us is frustrating. Just simply downright frustrating. I think it is for all experiencers. It's hard to live this life, and that's what I kind of meant by that little pet phrase of mine, dying is hard, but living, coming back to life is harder. Because you've had this glimpse, you've had this awakening, you know that there's that spiritual connection that you have, and you have this physical means that we have to live this life. It's incredibly difficult, and I'm not going to make light of the situation because I know I have a lot of experiencer friends in our group that are really battling with it, and they're trying to find a way where they can make a living and where this isn't in conflict. And they're trying to find a way of supporting themselves and their families without this conflict of this within this duality. I had one guy quit his job because he knew what was going on behind the scenes intuitively, and he couldn't talk about it. And it bothered him so much he had to quit his job. I wish he hadn't, but I wish he'd tried to cope with it a little bit more. We have to develop some coping skills.
I just wanted to ask you the color of the being's eyes, and, you know, I was kind of judgmental, and I thought, how can I not judge so much?
I find strength about judgment in the near-death experience in the life review where they didn't judge. some of my harshest acts. And what I'm talking about, some of the things that I was most ashamed of in my near-death experience, was some of the pure rage that I had as a young man. I had a boiling rage within me that was unconfined. And I would lash out at people unrestricted.
And another thing I didn't say is like what's in our heart. You know, mm-hmm. What's in our heart when we kill that little insect?
Yeah.
What was we feeling?
Yeah.
You know?
I count my blessings that I was given that gift of seeing that, of not being judged, you know. It was a gift.
I was just wondering if you had any type of a religious affiliation before this happened to you, and how, if you did, how that has affected how you think now, and also about what might happen. Are you maybe a believer in, you said you used the term live for eternity, but do you believe that you might be able to come back as a, in another form or another person or have another life experience? I'm just curious to know your thoughts.
Okay. This is my belief. Before my near-death experience, I grew up, I tried to mention I had a dysfunctional kind of life. My mom used to kind of farm me out to different families because I was born in an age where being a single mom just wasn't a cool thing. And so she thought she was doing the best thing for me by putting me with other families. Unfortunately, I was like the fifth wheel in a lot of situations, and there was abuse and things like that. And then she'd find out, she'd yank me out of that family, throw me in with another one who might even be worse or neglectful or all of that. But in all these families, they all tried to subject me to their beliefs and their faith. So I got a good taste of a lot of different faiths at a young age. And then my mother took me back. We moved out to Arizona at the age of 14. And her mate at the time, they used to just fight day and night. Done. The minute their heads came off the pillow to the minute they put them back on the pillow, they fought. And so I spent that time of my life escaping them. And I got to know quite a few Native American folks down there because most of my friends were Navajo or Hopi. And their mothers kind of took me in a little bit and shared some of their belief with me. So I got to see some of that. But the funny thing was, before my near-death experience, I never really took any of it to heart. I wasn't living any spiritual life, really, before. After the near-death experience, it's so profoundly spiritual that I started to look for the spirit in all things. I kind of consider myself a person of the world, and I want to see what's spiritual. I want to honor all spirituality. I tend to resonate because I don't know if it was those grandmothers and how loving they were to me and how they showed some compassion in my life before I knew what compassion was. I tend to resonate with some of their beliefs. I found some other beliefs that embrace the near-death experience, and I look at them a lot closer. But I can't really profess the one, because when I say my morning gratitudes, I tend to mix a lot of it in there. I tend to mix a lot of what I found to be truths, kind of universal truths, in with my gratitudes every day. I don't know. I don't know how to answer your question. Now, as far as do we come back again, I believe that only a part of me is here right now. I believe my greater being is still with that family, and that's how I have that connection, and that we can all develop that connection. I don't think there's any magic there. But you know what? I'll probably come. I think there's another opportunity for me.
When you had the experience with the first being that talked to you, and you heard his voice or her voice, was it male or female? Was it anything that you would recognize as such?
Oh yeah, someone else asked if my soul family is male or female too, and then the voice. Because the voice was separate. Then the voice came from the light. And this voice was, like I said, it felt like a parental voice to me. It felt like almost like a loving mother that was dripping with love and compassion, was telling me what this kid needed to do. As far as gender. I really didn't feel gender. I don't know. I know some people do. I've talked to other experiencers who have felt that. But I don't know. It just wasn't anything that has ever really focused in that light with me. It's just not my experience, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, I guess. Because I don't know. I think it's much more complicated than we can perceive.
Now, when you receive this guidance from this family and these beings and that, do you hear it as thoughts in your head? Or do you hear a voice, literally? Or how does that exchange go?
Depends how good I'm listening sometimes. I see flashes. I see things sometimes. A lot of times I still get those, what I call my knowings. I just understand a situation or I understand a subject better than I have ever studied it or was taught in college. When my soul group talks to me, it's a voice a lot of times. It took me a while. I had to develop some discernment because we have my friend, I have a friend back home, she calls it the monkey mind. You know, the chitter-chatters all the time. When you're trying to meditate and things, you know, you're trying to quiet that monkey mind because it just won't quiet down. And within that monkey mind, you've got your judgment self, you've got the this self, the that self, you know, your critical self, and you've got, you know, all these little components within that monkey mind. Well, when Spirit first started speaking, and when Spirit speaks still to this day, I've learned that there's an actual physical sensation that I feel. Because the brain, there's no physical sensation with it. But I can feel it in my heart when Spirit speaks. I tuned into that so that there's no doubt which is which.
When you were with your family on the other side, and after you come back, do you feel there's any connection between... Do you feel any connection between that family, a spiritual family that you feel so close to, your present, past, or any family that you've been associated with here on Earth while you've been here in this life?
I wish I could say I did, but I don't. My mother is my only living relation that I have, that I know of, that's blood. I mean, I have my stepfather, he's crossed over, my stepfather. And some people that I did cherish that helped, that were some positive influences, they've passed over. But they're not a part of this group. There's no one here. None of them are living in life with me. That I think adds to my isolation. I have a longing every day to go home. Again, I would never do anything to shorten life's experiences, but I have a longing to go home.